This is Wins and Losses with Clay Travis. Clay talks with the most entertaining people in sports, entertainment, and business. Now, here's Clay Travis.
Welcome into the Wins and Losses podcast. This is only our second edition of this podcast. First week was Jason Whitlock. We're going to be joined this week by Shannon Terry at SBTerry247 on Twitter. I think you guys are going to love his story, and I'm excited to dive in with him now. We are joined this week by Shannon Terry. For those of you who do not know Shannon, he has built up the Rivals Network and sold it to Yahoo. He has built up 24/7 Sports and sold it to CBS. He's got another universe of the web that he has built called popculture.com. We'll ask him all about that. Comicbook.com, all different sorts of arenas there. But the concept for Wins and Losses, if you have not listened before, is I feel like a lot of time we focus on the successes that people have in life, and we don't talk about what they learned from losses along the way, or even how close a win may have felt to a loss, or vice versa. I've known Shannon for a while. I'm going to bring him in now. He lives where I do in Nashville, Tennessee. He came up here, and I want to start there. Shannon, you were an athlete who comes to Nashville. You grew up in North Alabama. How did you find yourself kind of growing up? What was your background like? And I'll start there. So you're from North Alabama. What was your hometown like? What was your early childhood like when you were growing up?
Yeah, so I grew up in Woodville, which is about 20 miles east of Huntsville, in that Gunnersville, Scottsboro, Huntsville corridor. Really, really small town. I think at the time I was there, it was about 300 people. The first school I went to for 11 years, we had 25 in our graduating class. I transferred my senior year because of athletics. Farming community, you know, relatively. You know, lower middle class. My mom was an assistant at the Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville and retired and became a substitute teacher, I guess when I was in the sixth or seventh grade. And then my dad took two jobs. He was a career farmer, but also worked at PPG Industries in Huntsville. So very, very humble, you know, beginnings, but, you know, really strong, you know, family unit and really good parents, grandparents.
You grew up on a farm?
I grew up on a farm. Hated every minute of it.
You did chores like they had you out like when you were a kid? Did you remember, I mean, because I think for a lot of people who'll be listening, I mean, that's kind of almost a cliche idea now that you grow up on a farm and obviously to make a living in the tech industry like you do now. But what are your earliest memories of growing up on the farm? Do you remember doing the farm chores? I mean, what kind of lifestyle did you have when you were a kid?
Oh, I mean, mine is, you know, the very cliche. I mean, my dad worked second shift and third shift at PVG so that he could, you know, work his farm. He had, I don't know, 700-800 acres. My grandfather had a couple thousand, you know, cattle farms. So we grew crops. The crops were predominantly, though, to feed the herd, the cows. And, you know, from the moment I could walk, you know, relatively well, you know, I was doing everything, you know, cleaning out barns, baling hay, you know, driving tractors, you know, you name it. And quite honestly, you know, I've always considered myself a hard worker, but, you know, I'm very lazy compared to, you know, my parents, their parents. I mean, they have a completely different gear. And I think my interest in sports, you know, my interest in technology and some of the interests that I picked up in other areas over the years, you know, whether it's reading or whatever, was because I didn't want to be a farmer. I mean, it was, you know, there was nothing glorious about what we were doing. I mean, it was always, you know, equipment failure, you know, weather concerns, you know, rising cost. I mean, it was, you know, it was no joke. I mean, being on a small farm was, you know, a lot of hard work and a lot of struggles.
So you're waking up. Do you remember having an epiphany where you're like, man, I could never do this for a living? Because a lot of people come into farming and kind of take over from their parents, right, and end up doing exactly what they did. Do you remember at a young age being and having that epiphany where you said, I can't do this. I don't want to do this.
You know, my parents, they were hard workers and they were tough on me, but they were always good. I mean, if I had to go, you know, do something for sports, you know, it was always no questions asked, you know, you don't have to show up, you know, do your chores. By the way, I didn't get an allowance. I just did chores. And so in my mind, it was one of those back of the mind kind of things. But I'll tell you where it really was just like, screw this. I've had enough of it. My freshman year in college at David Lipscomb, I redshirted, and we had some Belgian horses. I think we had four of them that my grandfather had, and the purpose of them, they were logging horses, and he had them for novelty. And they ate the remnants of the soybean. And I'd baled hay all my life, and it was no big deal. But when you run a hay baler behind a harvested soybean field and rake all that and bale all that, you're talking 150 pounds of dust. And so for one summer straight, three or four times at different times, we'd bale that soybean remnant up. And I'm telling you, I ate more dust. It messed up my sinuses. I think it took me a year and a half of college to get over that. And that was, it wasn't an epiphany, but it was a door slamming. You know, I wasn't the guy that said, hey, if I ever make it, I'm going to go have one of those farms like they have on TV. I was done with it. I was done with the abuse, and I had moved on. So, you know, as I've gotten older, I realized that I realize the value that I learned, the freedom, the ability to just, you know, exist without the need for technology or being around people. And I wish that, you know, I wish my kids, I've got four kids now, could experience a lot of the things that I experienced growing up.
So when did you, so you said you kind of came into sports. When did you start to play sports, and when did you start to realize, hey, I'm pretty good at this?
I was good at an early age. So I was good. I mean, pretty much third, fourth grade, you know, or whatever. I mean, again, a town of 300 people. I remember the day I got television, and we got, what, four or five channels that were, you know, it was like, what, WGN and TBS, you know, outside of the rabbit ears. So I didn't have a whole lot to do. Played baseball, played basketball. And, I mean, for the most part, I was really good at basketball from the day I picked it up.
And so you start playing basketball, and at what time do you start thinking, hey, I might be good enough to go to college? Did your parents go to college, people around? You're in North Alabama, I think you said 20 or 30 miles outside of Huntsville. When did you start thinking, hey, my world could expand a little bit, and I might be able to go to college and become a legitimate possibility through basketball?
Sure. Eighth grade, I started playing a lot with high school kids, you know, in the Huntsville area, in the Jackson County, Madison County area, and a lot of kids that were going on to be college players, and I was, you know, holding my own, so to speak. So I think eighth or ninth grade, it wasn't a matter of whether I was going to be a college basketball player. It was the level in which I was going to play. My junior year, I think I averaged, I don't know, 35 points a game or so. I was MVP of Vanderbilt's basketball camp. It was, you know, and I was hoping to be, I knew I wasn't an SEC level because I was kind of a poor man's, more of a, kind of a, I was a stretch forward, but, you know, only about 6'4 and a half. So I was a little short to be an SEC player for the style of play. I was hoping to be more, you know, that next level down. But I ended up actually breaking my arm three or four weeks before my senior year that required two surgeries. And so that set me back. I didn't come back, you know, strong until several weeks into the season.
How'd you break your arm?
Just goofing around in the backyard. Never had an injury in my life, and fell and shattered the main bone in my arm. Came out through the skin. Big mess. Ended up having surgery at Houston Medical Clinic in Columbus, Georgia, by James Andrews at
the
time.
Oh, wow.
And he had just started. Yes, he had just started that practice. I think he had just left Auburn at that time. Obviously, I wasn't one of his famous clients, but they fixed me up and ended up coming back for the season, and we had a really good senior year. We lost by 1 point in the finals of the state tournament and signed with Lipscomb later that year.
So the minute you hurt your arm, did you think, oh my God, like, I've ruined my basketball career? I mean, how quickly did you have that thought, almost instantaneously?
Yeah, I mean, you know, here's the thing. I wasn't an automatic going into my senior year. I was one of those guys that was going to have to work to get a college scholarship. I made really good grades in high school, so I wasn't going to go, you know, to some junk school. And so for me to play athletics, I was going to have to get it done my senior year. And then I guess a month and a half, I can't remember, is when, you know, I had that bad break. And so in my mind, it was over. There was no way to come back. Luckily, it wasn't my shooting arm. It was the other. First play I came back, though, I dislocated my elbow. I had so much atrophy in my arm. You know, I had to fight a lot of injuries my senior year. But, you know, all these things are just learning experiences. You don't trade. You know, you learn as humans. We learn a lot more from our losses and failures than I think we do our successes. So I think all of those things I went through in life made me a better CEO, better leader, better entrepreneur as I developed, you know, as I got ready for those opportunities in my late 20s.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
So you come up to Nashville. How much traveling did you do growing up? Did you travel around very much, or did you spend any time much outside of the area where you grew up? Did you know anything about Nashville? I mean, because for a lot of people who are listening right now, they're going to, you know, think North Alabama to Nashville is not that much of a difference. I mean, for people who haven't traveled in that area, I mean, that's a big cultural difference to go from rural Alabama to suddenly being in Nashville. How familiar, how comfortable were you with that move?
That's an awesome statement because it brings back so many memories. So to me, the equivalent today would be my kids going to school in Juneau, Alaska.
Right.
Like, yeah. You know, I mean, seriously, like it is. It was Nashville wasn't even on the map. I mean, now I'll say this, two kind of interesting points. I don't remember ever going on a family vacation growing up. I'm trying to think, you know, I had an unbelievable childhood. My parents were amazing. You know, I was that kid that felt loved. I was supported in every way. My parents gave their shirt off their backs for, you know, for me athletically and academically. But I don't think we ever went on a single family vacation. And that's mind-boggling. Think of how many trips you take your kids.
Oh, it's astounding. And you take yours now and all the places you've been with them. But when you were a kid, you didn't go anywhere.
Not one. I mean, listen, not one single vacation. Now, we'll say this. I went to Lipscomb Coach Myers basketball camp for 4 years, I guess, starting either in the eighth or ninth grade. I can't remember. Outside of that trip, maybe a few trips for basketball, AAU type stuff in Birmingham. You know, that was it for me. I mean, I was a country boy, you know, from Woodville, Alabama, that, you know, it was inconceivable for my parents to spend their hardworking dollars, you know, at Disney or wherever.
Or even the beach. It's not that far of a drive, right, to the beach from North Alabama. But you guys didn't take trips down to the beach hardly.
No, not hardly. Clay,
yeah,
we're talking
never.
Zero. Never. Didn't happen. Didn't want it because it didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't I didn't have a temptation to go. Didn't mean anything. Didn't register. So, you know, I love looking back thinking, you know, how different life would be had I had the experiences, you know, visiting the places that my children have visited. But then again, who knows? You know, maybe – you know, everything kind of, maybe things happen for a reason. Who knows? Who cares?
So then come Don Meyer, right? I mean, who is one of the most iconic basketball coaches of all time. You show up, you're a, you know, country kid. You haven't spent very much time living in any kind of city at all. You show up in Nashville. You enroll at David Lipscomb. How prepared were you to be there? How quickly did it take you to get comfortable? You said you redshirted, but
yeah.
In that cultural switch, how long did it take you to feel comfortable at Lipscomb?
You know, I don't know that I ever got comfortable there. Looking back, you know, I think my whole, you know, I look at it and I did really well academically at Lipscomb and I enjoy my time. And I think I adapted more from Coach Meyer than I adopted. I saw a lot of his flaws, but I wasn't the alpha leader, so. you know, I kind of just had to sit back and observe and take notes. I think early on, I don't think Coach Meyer liked me very much. I don't think he knew how to react. I wasn't the type that just say go do it. You know, you got to show it. I got to see it. I'm not a rule breaker, but I'm not a real follower either. And you know, Coach Meyer was a very brainwashed, very structured, you know, type system, which was good for me in one sense. But you know, I don't know that I ever really found my place, you know, at Lipscomb. But from an athletics perspective, but everything that I learned during that window helped shape the way that I managed, prepared, the strategies that I built, and the way that I led and built organizations. So, you know, I really, looking back, think, you know, and I think I finished there as the ninth leading scorer in school history at the time. My senior class is the winningest class in history of college basketball, and so it was a great experience. I think I would have personally had a much better experience at a number of other schools. But I think the reason that I was meant to be there was it was really the start of my learning how to be a leader and how to be an organizational builder. And that's what Coach Meyer was. And I learned so much from him. You know, I could never replace or substitute those experiences.
What'd you major in at Lipscomb?
I was at finance, economics.
So what did you think you were going to do when you – I mean, because you go to Lipscomb, at that point you're probably acknowledging, hey, my career at basketball is going to end at this level. It's a high level. You get a college scholarship, you're playing, you said you have a tremendous amount of success, but it's not as if you get to college thinking, oh, maybe the next step is – maybe you thought I could play in Europe for a couple of years, I don't know. Or did you almost immediately say, hey, I got 4 or 5 years here, and then I've got to figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life?
No, I knew, you know, I knew the minute that, you know, I signed at Lipscomb. You know, I had Lipscomb in a few schools similar to Lipscomb, you know, in every single JUCO you could name. I knew the minute that I went to Lipscomb versus, you know, junior college route, that there would be no professional sports. And I was, you know, completely fine. Clay, my dream and passion was to always to build and run companies. So I went to Lipscomb the same reason, you know, I went to Lipscomb to learn. I went to Lipscomb to learn how to build, you know, a better me and hopes of someday either buying a business or starting a business. And so I am living, you know, from the day, my parents will tell you, from the days I could think of anything more than, you know, cartoons, I've always wanted to run and own a business. And
where
so
did that, where did that drive come from? Because it's not like you grew up, I mean, I know your parents have a farm and that's a business in and of itself, but where do you think that drive to want to be involved in the business universe came from?
I don't know. I know this. I know that my mother and my father and my grandmother and my grandfather on the other side are as competitive humans as there can be. And so, you know, I was raised, you know, I'll never forget. Here's a great story about my dad. You know, they'd come to every game at Lipscomb. After the game, they'd take me, what was the name of the restaurant? Not Friday's, but the one on the corner in Green Hills that I think is
The Cooker?
Not be close, but it was like they would always go to the same place. Had the big salad bar, Ruby Tuesdays.
Okay, yeah.
In Green Hills. Yeah, so we'd go there every time. We ventured to Crystal one night. I'll never forget this. So we ordered. We get all the way back to the campus. My dad starts going through his money. Crystal overpaid him like 17 cents or whatever. We got in the car and we went back to Crystal to give them the 17 cents. And, you know, my parents were... they were just those people. They're just those people. They're, you know, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. It's worth doing ethical, you know, and no one on the planet is going to outwork those two. And so I think, you know, watching that, you know, watching a family that they may not, you know, been going to Duke or Harvard, you know, but in their world, they were the best of the best, you know, I think and created values in the way that I looked at life and what I wanted to try to be. I just didn't know how big the universe was.
So you're at Lipscomb, you're majoring in economics, you're thinking you want to get involved in business. When's the first time you ever got on the internet?
Oh, gosh, web crawler. I was married because I remember when it happened. Someone showed me web crawler. I don't know if you remember that search engine. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, we did a search for something and, you know, 200 or 300 links came up. But, you know, before web crawler, you know, I was on the bulletin boards and, you know, all that stuff. I always had kind of a, you know, an eye for technology. So early on.
Did you have a computer at your house in Alabama?
You know, I didn't, but I did. I did my senior year. I think it was a Mac SE or the Mac 20 was the first computer that I bought. It was the one you had to change the floppies out along the way. And then I got the Mac SE or Mac 20, which one of them, which had like a 20 meg hard drive that I carted off to Lipscomb. So, yeah, that's when I got my first machine.
So, I haven't even asked you about this, but you grew up in Alabama. You grew up a big fan of Alabama sports, Alabama football, Alabama basketball. Were you watching and listening to those games on the radio as a kid growing up?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things, my sixth grade basketball coach, I would ride actually to every Alabama game. He had a van with, I don't know, 6 or 7 people, and he allowed me to ride with him. So I would go, I guess this started in about the 7th or 8th grade, I'd ride with him, go scalp tickets and, you know, try to make enough money to buy for my ticket. I'd usually sit by myself. That's how warped I was then. But I would play with the whole, hey, I don't have a ticket, get one, and then work my way up and hopefully leave the games in Legion Field with a, you know, few 20s in my pocket and a free game ticket. I did that until my senior year in high school.
So wait, you would show up without a ticket, hope that somebody gave you a ticket, and then trade up and make money over the course of, like, scalping? Yeah, hustling it.
Every game for 5 years.
Amazing. What's the most you ever made? Do you remember making like $100 for a game or something like that?
You know, my subconscious says I made like 120 one weekend, but you know, every story gets more grandeur over time.
What was the best game you saw there in Legion Field as a kid?
You can see me on the kick. I'm in that video. I've seen that one. I've seen them all. I saw, you know, Heath Shuler. I saw the game where Alabama came back and tied. I saw the kick. I mean, I don't think I missed a home game from about the 7th grade to my senior year, and I changed schools my senior year. So I went to all of them.
For people out there who are younger, and there are going to be a lot of people who are younger, before the internet took off and before there were message boards and before there was Rivals and 24/7 and Scout and the recruiting industry in general, there were 1-900 phone numbers that you could call to get updates on recruits. When you were a kid and as you're going to Lipscomb, were you one of those people who was aware of that 1-900 business? Because there was tons of money that was made off fans back then, but that was the way you'd get the information. And then sports talk radio kind of started to grow. But where did you get interested in recruiting? Were you aware of that business, the 1-900 call number?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that all of these reasons kind of set up into the industry that I was in. So I'm an SEC football addict, okay?
Yeah.
My family, you know, were distantly related to Phil Fulmer. I was a huge Tennessee fan. You know, hard to say that out loud. I'm still a huge Tennessee fan. You know, but how can you be both? Well, you know, there's a lot
North Alabama, a lot of times that happens, actually, right? You're close to the border with Tennessee, for people who don't know the geography, and it's just a football and it's a sports-crazy area in general.
It's sports-crazy area. So I was, you know, huge Alabama fan, and then Tennessee, you know, was my second team, but I watched every SEC game, went to them. So here I go. I cart off to Lipscomb. And guess what? Lipscomb is not, you know, at that point in time, there's no internet, you know, no cable TV. And then furthermore, we have morning meetings. We have naps. We have shoot-arounds on Saturdays. We have long bus trips on Saturdays. We have games on Saturdays. For essentially 5 years, I don't remember seeing a college football game. And so what I did during that time is I subscribed to the Tuscaloosa News. I subscribed to a print magazine called Bama Mag at the time. I started reading the recruiting magazines, National Recruiting Advisor, Alan Wallace, a lot of these. And then I was addicted to Bob Bell and Bill King's WLSC AM show because yes. It was, you know, just a phenomenal message board of sorts, you know, for SEC discussion. And so, you know, losing that passion, I didn't lose the passion. I just didn't have,
you lost know, your access. Yeah.
Yeah, we're at Lipscomb. There are no, listen, you know, I was an economics major. Academics were unbelievably important to me. I worked my ass off in school, and then Coach Meyer had the most rigorous, you know, program you could have. I didn't have a free second, one, to even consider, you know, keeping up with it. But I did the best I could. All that did, when I got out of school, you know, a couple years later, it made all the lights go off. And so when, you know, when I started looking at the internet, I'll never forget that first time I looked at it and I said, this is the perfect distribution vehicle for a combination of, I'll never forget, I likened or I compared Bob Bell and Bill King's radio show to a message board. And you know, I didn't think at the time newspapers were doing an exceptional job online. And so there was an immediate opportunity to start covering the team. You know, there were so many factors there. I was like, this has no chance of losing, you know, because there's this huge demand for this sport. And now you've got a distribution pipe like no other, you know. There's no limit to, you know, and I can tell you where we were when we started Rivals and how it's, I'm sorry, yeah, the first version of it and how it started. And the day we started it, there were literally 30 days after, there was never a question it was going to be ultra successful.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
So, yeah, tell me about Rivals. So you are a recruiting obsessive. You're an SEC football fan. It's incredibly fertile. You graduate from Lipscomb and take another job. What do you do directly when you graduate from Lipscomb?
I work at First American National Bank, which I don't think is around at this point in time, but it was you know, probably the local bank of its time in Nashville. I worked there for 2 years. I was a financial analyst for lenders. So basically, a relationship manager wants to lend money to a business. It's got to go through a credit review and financial review. And so I was the nerd behind the scenes that was, you know, doing the 20-page analysis on whether that business was worthy of that loan by that bank. So did that for 2 years. It was really, really good for me because it was a training on, you know, cash flow statements and, you know, income statements are easy, you know, but basically, you know,
is this company a good risk? Like, you're basically just looking at balance sheets all the time and trying to figure out whether they're good risk for the bank.
Yeah, that's it. And then you got to articulate it in words, which is, you know, it's one thing looking at, you know, all these financial reports, but then when you've got to, you know, back it up, you know, with a reasonable, well-written thought, it's a whole different game. So I did that for 2 years. Then I went to work as a freelance writer for a stock market research company. And so I did that for basically pennies on the dollar for access to level 2 quotes and got into day trading.
So at that time, how would you distribute your writing? Was that a written product? I mean, like a print product that you guys would distribute, or how did your writing get out to the audience?
Yeah, so they had Quotron. They had basic services. It was non-internet at the time. So they had these, I think it was called level 2 quote machines, Bloomberg machines, these type of machines that the financial community would get research and data from. And so the owner did deals to get to get these devices. What was interesting to me was it was an opportunity to get level two quotes. I had built up an unbelievable nest egg from being a farmer. You know, I was an RA in college. I ref games in college. I gave ACT, SAT administration. You know, so I was 23, 24 years old and had a boatload of money.
What would a boatload of money have been to you at 23 or 24?
I probably had $100,000.
So you had saved, I mean, you had saved up a ton. Yeah. Like, you didn't have to pay for college. You were getting, you know, like, and you worked. And so you had saved up basically everything you made. Where'd you live in Nashville at the time?
I had just gotten married. So I was living in Burton Hills in a condo, there. So, you know, so I'd made a bunch of successful stock investments at the time. I rode Walmart, you know, through one of its big, you know, runs. There were several other, you know, back in the day. And so I'm like, well, I need these quotes. I'll go over here. He would assign me basically very similar to the bank. I do analysis and submit them. He would then author them, whatever. He ended up getting sued by the Securities Exchange Commission. I was looped into that lawsuit. And so I quit. And then after, I guess, about a year of basically, you know, getting back on my feet, so to speak, I started Rivals. And so
hold on, Philip, you're 24 or 25. You're a kid. You get investigated by the SEC, you know, for the day trading, basically. I mean, what year is this? Like 1992, 93, something like that? What year are we talking about?
I think four. They all kind of run together. Yeah, somewhere around that time.
Okay, so then you have to get that all cleaned up. I mean, that has to be crazy to be a kid and suddenly have all that over your head, right? I mean, you, at that point in time, you said your dad returned 17 cents from Crystal. You had to be like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? You get that resolved, and along that time, you start thinking, what am I going to do next? Is that kind of the game plan?
100%. I never, you know, my intention was never to be in the financial sector. You know, again, you know, that was the last thing. So it wasn't difficult at all transitioning, you know, out. And the whole time I was there, I was, you know, trying to decide, you know, what I wanted to do, you know, in my next career. But, you know, once the civil suit, from my perspective, was settled, you know, it's here I am. I've got a daughter at the time, married. You know, no one's going to feel sorry for yourself. So, you know, you just put your head down and grind. But again, all of these things that, you know, the good, the bad, the wins, the losses, are what set me up to crush these next, you know, three decades. And so, you know, they were ready. I remember I called my college friend who had just left Anderson or Accenture or whatever, and he was working at FedEx in Memphis, and he's a brilliant guy, an engineer. I called him. I said, hey, Greg, this was shortly thereafter, I've got an idea on something that'll make us a lot of money. He said, let's go to lunch. And so I met him in Cool Springs at this Italian place. On the proverbial napkin, I drew out a plan for Rivals, which at the time was Alliance Sports. And I said, but I'm going to need $30,000 from you if you want to own half of it. And he said, got it. And so we put $60,000 in a bank account, and we started building, which I think was the genius of that play, is we built the first dynamic content management system. And what I mean by that is you take for granted going on Facebook or Twitter and making an update, and that update writes to the database and immediately appears to the world. We wrote one of those systems back in 1996, and we did it with multiple layers of permission. And so it allowed me to take that content management system and go set up 13 team sites with 20-something writers in different areas of the country that could post automatically to the web with different levels of permission, different levels of user access, to actually start building these individual publications. And that was in 1996 with Alliance Sports.
Okay, so how did you learn? Did you know the tech of how to build? Did you hire people? How did you even come up with the idea of what the – because nowadays, to people who are listening to us now, the existence of message boards in the world of sports are so commonplace that it's hard to think about how they were originally designed, if that makes sense. I think there's probably a lot of people out there who understand this question, even though it's not been artfully phrased yet. How do you decide what a internet website focused on a team will be like? Like, what was your game plan to make that decision even possible?
So here's the thing. So I grew up on a farm, and we always had lots of lumber, lots of steel, and we always had lots of raw materials. And so I spent a decade learning how to build things. You know, like, you can't do this until you do this.
And physically build things.
Physically build things, from gates to trailers to whatever. I watched my dad, who's a mechanical genius, you know, do these things. And so everything has an order, you know, and a practical use, you know, form. And so I knew how to architect things. Greg taught me some very basic coding strategies early on, and then enough to work with engineers. I mean, could I have gone and learned and been an engineer? Sure. I mean, that wasn't the path that I wanted to go on, but I could speak their language. And so I knew enough to be dangerous. You know, even to this day, I still run product development for all of our brands and built all the products at Rivals and 24/7 that you see today. And so I've always had my hand in that. You know, the last 20 years, I just basically work with people that are great at what they do. But so, you know, I started mapping out those products, and then we hired two superstar coders. I mean, they're just phenomenal coders that built an unbelievable content management system, a great message board, and the very first recruiting database for Alliance Sports. And Alliance Sports, just to put in perspective, we launched that thing with not a single eyeball, and in 4 years, it had grown to a couple million in sales and was just a beast. That thing made so much money. It never had a day where we were concerned about selling. We just didn't know. We didn't know we were at the forefront of the internet revolution. We didn't know that, you know, when we sold that business for $3 million in 1999, we probably could have sold it for $40.
Yeah.
You know, just didn't know. We had no clue. You know, we didn't know what we were doing. We just knew how to build a business and run one. We didn't know what we really had. So
how do you decide? So you're starting Alliance Sports. How do you decide what teams to focus on? How do you find writers? And how do you hit on the business model, which ended up being so incredibly successful? I mean, there's still media companies, like all the newspaper companies collapsed and everything else. You guys hit on something that The Athletic's trying to do now, which was, hey, we're going to charge people a monthly fee. And at the time, I mean, this is pretty revolutionary because a lot of the internet is everything's supposed to be free, right? Like, that's what they're preaching, certainly back in the late 90s. How do you come up with that idea? Teams to follow, how the business model will work, how do you find writers, all of those things?
Well, teams are easy. Teams where, you know, who has the big e-com or, you know, merchandise deals, largest alumni base, most passionate following, largest athletic budgets. I mean, those were easy. I mean, and,
you got a big football stadium. You should have your own internet site. I mean, and it's an easy way that you guys would have picked the teams that you did. But were you focused almost exclusively in the Southeast at the time, or were you Ohio State? Do you have Big Ten schools? Like, which schools did you start with?
SEC, Texas, and Texas A&M. So we were working that corridor, and then we didn't do anything at North Carolina at the time, but we tried Clemson and Florida State. So we were trying to work, you know, what we would consider, you know, the South, where the socioeconomics, you know, were people. Look, I don't know how to say this without being disrespectful, and I'm certainly not meaning to, but, you know, people in Birmingham, Alabama, don't have as much to do as people in Manhattan.
Yeah.
So, a large piece of people's identities are around the teams that they follow in college, and that, you know, these Southern schools and some of these, you know, big Ten schools are just right to cultivate that passion. And I think that's what we've done over the years. We've fed the beast and helped create the beast. So it was that was easy to figure out. As it relates to the model, we started out free.
With the idea that you were going to make money off ads was probably your initial plan, right?
We knew we weren't going to make enough, yeah. but we wanted it to scale. And so once we saw scale slow down, because you got to remember, in those days, you went to a website by typing it in. There was no such thing as distribution through Facebook, Reddit, Twitter,
or even Google
search, correct. And so it made sense that, okay, what we'll do is we'll create a club in these message boards, and people want to be a part of a club. They want to be a part of something. And so we actually sold the club more than we sold breaking news. And so if you look at, you look at the sales model for the membership, it was really around join this club. Then it was exclusive recruiting scoop. Let's own recruiting. And then it was team news, as the third piece. And we found, guess what? You didn't have Netflix to compete with. You didn't have, right now, I don't even want to know all the things I subscribe to. In those days, you may or may not had SI print. You may or may not had a newspaper. You didn't have many 495s coming out of your bank statement. Yeah. Every month. So it wasn't that difficult to build that, free and premium model. And again, the reason Rivals was so successful, and it was a joke successful, is because we had 4 years with Alliance Sports making every mistake at a small scale level. That when we got Rivals in whatever year that was, 2004 or 3, I don't even remember, they all run together. It was just, okay, here's our strategy, buy into it or get out of the way, we're going. And, we didn't deviate much from it. So the script was written.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
So initially, that first time when you flipped the switch on Alliance, how do you go find Alabama? You say, because I think that's interesting for a lot of people who are listening to us right now. There's no Google. There's no Facebook. There's no Twitter. There's no existing social networks really on the internet outside of maybe people would go to Yahoo.com, early days internet. Maybe you would go to AOL.com. How did you get the word out that your sites existed?
Oh, radio. I mean, our guys, I was the content provider for the Alabama site in the midst of all this. So I was the lead, I was the expert, so to speak. And so I had an intimate knowledge of how to run the business from being the boots on the street, just like you've done all these years. I ran it from the top down and the bottom up. And so I took that experience and started hiring these J school graduates that were about 2 years out of school that were working with these small county papers, that sold ads, wrote copy, edited copy, updated their own stories, And so I took these kind of multi-tool, low-cost players and trained them how to be publishers on the web in these markets. And then we used our professional collateral of the brand and got them on, helped get them on radio in their local markets. And so I would say the local radio did more for growing. And then the beauty of our model is once a consumer, a user found us, we had a chance of them sticking because of these message board communities.
Right.
A writer can write 2 or 3 things a day. If that's all you've got, a user is dipping in and out. But if you've got a community, users would come in and check that thing 10 times a day. Created an incredible sticky experience that allowed us to build these communities when there wasn't social and search as the distribution arm.
So when you start charging, all right, you've built Alliance, you have that moment where you're going to say, what was your initial monthly charge or what was your subscription cost?
I want to say we were $29 annual.
Okay.
But I think we upped it to 49 pretty quick.
So that moment where you start to charge, everybody who has ever started a business has that moment where they have to wait. Do you remember, like, I've read a lot of different stories about businesses where they have like a little bell that'll ding every time. I think that was at Amazon. Every time they got an order, you know, something would ding. How quickly did you realize, okay, people are going to pay for this?
Well, this is also embarrassing to say. Okay, we had, you know, thousands of subscribers, but the credit cards and the renewals were run by Greg Goff and myself. Now, Greg probably ran 85% of them, and I ran the other 15%. Now, what that physically means is that we would take the credit cards off the secure server and actually enter them into the device. And so we knew we had a business when we were spending hours upon hours actually physically manually inputting all the data. I mean, the credit card data.
So you did that yourself, you and an employee. Yeah. Like, it wasn't like you had PayPal or, you know, Square or something like that. Like, you guys had to put in all those numbers.
We did it all. Wrote the system, ran the credit cards, managed the riders. In my case, was a reporter. We did it all. And so, you know, like I said, when we left Alliance after 4 years and had the opportunity to buy the rival's asset out of bankruptcy, we didn't come at it with just this CEO mentality. We came at it with a skill package and an experience package of doing everything from sweeping the floors to budgeting and forecast and capital. We had done it all. Now, not necessarily great, but there wasn't a job function that we didn't physically do.
How many people are working at Alliance at the time when you guys start to pivot to start Rivals?
Greg and I owned essentially 50-50. We were the shareholders. We had three developers, if I recall, and I think we had about 15 riders.
And you're running that business out of where at the time?
I had a 10x10 office, and Greg's may have been a little larger because he came from Arthur Anderson and definitely was a higher socioeconomic than me at the time.
So you guys sell that first business, that first recruiting business. Who'd you sell to?
We sold to basically a company called Rival Networks, which was the first group that started Rivals.
And so they were trying to put together like you were the South at the time, and they're trying to put together a national network of these same sites?
They were going public with Goldman, and they felt that their IPO would be much stronger if they bought the competitor.
Yeah.
So we didn't know. They misled us on their size. They paid us $3 million cash for the deal. They misled us on their size and where they were. They were, as you know, bankrupt in 6 months, you know, post-following.
So that's like the peak of the what year would that have been, like, roughly?
Yep. Goodness, that was the, 2003 or 4?
Right as the dot-com boom starts to kind of go up, and the, like, all these different companies, the pets.coms of the universe, are starting to finally run into reality.
Yeah, but, you know, their reality was they were spending $6 million a month and generating $25,000 in revenue. So it didn't have anything to do with, you know, they like to blame it on the dot-com. It had nothing to do with the dot-com. It was just, it was the worst run, worst managed company in the history of the internet, I'm convinced.
So you sell to the worst
thank God.
You sell. Like, you guys get around. I mean, you get seven figures, right? You're a young guy. You get seven figures. Then Rivals tanks, and you think, man, we need to try to buy this out of bankruptcy. That's your game plan at that time?
Absolutely. So the company Rivals' existing board hired a company, Sherwood Capital Partners, to liquidate the assets. So I called Sherwood to buy my non-compete. That's all I wanted. I didn't, you know, see any value in buying Rivals at the time. And so they refused to negotiate. They didn't want to do, you know, sell any parts of the asset. We didn't make a bid. And then several months later, called back, and they said, make a bid. And we ended up making a bid for $500,000 for the entire asset. And I think they had raised money at $150 million valuation.
Oh, my God.
We were the only bid at 500K. So we ended up buying Rivals out of bankruptcy for $500,000.
So were you in disbelief that you got the company for $500,000, or were you nervous that you would, I mean, like, how confident were you that you knew what to do?
About 1,000,000%. I mean, there was no, it was, I mean, that was easy. There was no chance of screwing that up. I'm not trying to sound arrogant. They were just, it was easy. I mean, that's what, you know, we were trained. We were ready for that. You know, I had gone through enough life experiences at that point to be a pretty good leader, and the strategy was already proven and tested on Alliance Sports. So we raised $2 million, we raised $2.5 million total, and we went at it. I think I want to say the first full year, we bought it half year. The first full year, we did about $7 million in sales. I think the business lost money for maybe 2 months. I don't know. There was never a day that it was a concern. When we sold it to Yahoo, you know, years later, we were approaching $30 million in sales, and it was wildly profitable.
So why do you think you guys were the only people who saw the existing latent value? There's a lot of people out there who are going to be listening now who get involved in business, and taking that risk is dangerous, taking that opportunity. There's a lot of people out there who now, in retrospect, can say, hey, there's a lot of fans that want to be served in these fan site-related communities. Yet this huge asset of Rivals, which, I mean, look, there were a lot of people who saw the business potential there because they had asset raise at $150 million or whatever it was, is sitting there and nobody else is even circling it. You yourself, if there had been other bidders, might not have jumped in and made the opportunity, made the bid that you did. Why do you think you guys saw the opportunity and others didn't?
Well, here's an totally unforgotten fact that everyone that likes to claim their power of Rivals forget. When we bought Rivals out of bankruptcy, we shut it down for 2 years. So we didn't turn on one single server. We didn't honor a single contract. We didn't have a credit card. We basically took it and shut it down and bought it and paid that $500 to have no competitors. So we launched Alliance Sports back for 2 years. And the reason we did, there were so many skeletons in the closet, you know, from data centers to vendors to unpaid publishers. I mean, that thing was it was an epic disaster. And so we didn't want to be dealing with, we're JBS Sports. We have nothing to do with that. You know, in my old school country ways, I'm like, you know, screw it, we're out. And so we relaunched Alliance Sports. I didn't rename it back to Rivals until I felt comfortable that risk had subsided. And the reason I did it, quite honestly, was Rivals was a hell of a lot better domain name than Alliance Sports. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, that was a time of endemic communities, passion plays, and serving the internet around a specific service where you had to be authentic and true. And we were trained in that discipline because we ran that business for 4 or 5 years. And so bigger brands, big business, running it from a top down, you know, they wouldn't understand as much of that, and they wouldn't see the large scale opportunities that existed. And I will say this, the Rivals model, the reason we sold it to Yahoo wasn't because of the $100 million payout. We could have gotten a valuation greater than that and sold any amount we wanted, recapped, and kept going. The Rivals model, when we sold that thing in 2007, or whenever the heck we sold it, again, I'm not good with dates, it was over. It had no more growth potential unless I completely blew the model up. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so for people out there who don't understand the Rivals business model, and I may be wrong, you can explain this or correct me. There were a lot of independent contractors that ran their own Rivals sites, right? Like, so if you were a fan of an Alabama team, the guy who ran the Rivals Alabama site owned that site. It wasn't owned by the larger Rivals Network. The larger Rivals Network was, you can explain it better than I can, I think, but that's my understanding. And so the flaw that you saw there was you had maybe a lot of cats you're trying to herd, but also you didn't necessarily own much tangible real estate.
Well, here's the key. That's not, we owned all the user data and we owned all the credit card data.
Okay.
And so, what Rivals did so well was we would put two entities in one market. Okay. And in some cases, three entities in a market. And that was our strategy Bobby and I had early on. In the event that one entity wanted to go to a higher deal, it didn't hurt us because we still had two publishing arms. And so we gave up a little margin to have ultimate insulation towards, you know, losing our business. So we could have easily started chopping and not really hurt our growth business. I did not want to start killing deals. You know, at the time I looked at Rivals, I looked at it as a legacy and as a family more than I did a business. You know, in hindsight, knowing the way that some of those guys have acted like jackasses since we left, I would have showed them who the real deal was, but didn't. You know, at the time, I didn't want to go in there and butcher those deals. And so I thought, okay, we're young. I really want to scale Rivals, but to scale it, I'm going to have to cut half the population. Let's just sell it. And then we'll revisit a new business in the future if an opportunity presents itself. And so that was, it all aligned to sell at that moment rather than reinvent it. I knew how to reinvent it. We knew what we wanted to do, you know, but we had maximized the endemic, passionate base. We needed to go towards more of the agnostic fan that still followed a team.
So you sell You sell Rivals to Yahoo.
Yeah.
You are then coming into Yahoo to work. What happened then? So you go from basically, I mean, you're kind of running this thing from the seat of your pants to a big top-down organization like Yahoo. What happens when you sell Rivals to Yahoo?
Yeah, so Rivals was in Yahoo was in complete turmoil at the time. You know, even during the year due diligence phase of the acquisition, you know, I think they'd gone through two CEOs at the time, you know, a lot of different strategic changes. So Yahoo was kind of not stable. I mean, it was the crown jewel of Silicon Valley media and then, you know, was beginning to tarnish. And then Yahoo also wanted to build its own sports editorial initiatives. And I think those editorial initiatives conflicted in a lot of cases with what I wanted to do at 24/7 Sports. Now, during my 2 years there, great things happened for Rivals and terrific things happened for Yahoo Sports under the leadership of Patara, Jimmy, you know, who now runs
ESPN.
The head guy at ESPN. Jimmy did a phenomenal job of building Yahoo Sports if you go back and giving me the latitude to do what I needed to do at Rivals. But you could see, if you really looked closer, you could see that if Jimmy wasn't the CEO of Yahoo, there was no way he was a rising star in media. There was no scenario he was going to be running Yahoo Sports very long. And Yahoo essentially was imploding in so many ways. So, you know, I'm not really a guy that's going to fight upward. You know, I'm just not that guy. So here's our strategy. Here's the numbers. Here's the thesis. You know, here's what it's going to look like. Get out of my way and let me execute. If I've got to run a bunch of initiatives, you know, for approval to a lot of people with less experience, it's just not my game. And Yahoo was becoming more of that type of consensus organization, and I wanted no part of it. So I was out the door.
So you make a good chunk, and I think honestly your story hasn't been told that much because I'll get to 24/7 here now, but to sell a company from basically nothing for $100 million in the world of sports And then to come back, you have to sit out for a little while, right? You have a non-compete with the Rivals acquisition?
One year. I had a two-year non-compete, and then I had a one-year employment tail, which I honored. You know, I'm proud to say that all the work that I did with 24/7 Sports occurred and started the day that that one-year tail expired. So
a lot of people, when they make – you made a lot of money, right? Like, you could have cashed in, you could have chilled, you could have done nothing else. But you were already thinking, like, I want to go back into this universe. You like what you're doing. I think earlier you said your parents are competitive, you're competitive. You knew, having worked at Alliance and having worked at Rivals, that there was an opportunity still to kind of take another bite at the apple and maybe finally get the company right. And so you decide to do and create now 24/7 Sports. What goes into that? What do you have to do? And what's the game plan that's different than what you had done so far? What did you learn?
So here's it in a nutshell. So if you look at the universe, let's say there's 4 million online, or whatever the number is, 2.5 million online Alabama fans, okay? Rivals' version of it was only targeting that 20% of diehards, okay? And what we saw was we wanted to be all things for all Alabama fans, all things for all Tennessee fans, Ohio State, Michigan, and so forth. Rivals wasn't built for that. And so I wanted to reach the more agnostic team fan that maybe they weren't season ticket holders, maybe they didn't watch every game, maybe they just used their sports team and their degree as social collateral, professional collateral. We wanted to build that engine. Now, we knew when we started 24/7 Sports, we weren't really even focused on Rivals, to be honest with you. It was, let's go build, you know, let's do 20 stories a day for the Alabama fan, not three, and let a lot of them be just the commodity news. And let's go win search, you know. And at that time, social wasn't as big. It was more about search starting to take off. So we were, instead of the 5 million uniques, you know, there's 190 million sports fans online. And Rivals would reach at that time, you know, we're somewhere between 5 to 8 million. We knew there was a good 30 million, 40 million that were on college. We wanted to go own that market. That was our play. So it was completely different. But I remember we launched 24/7, and I got this Facebook message from this guy who was a part-time writer for the Rivals Alabama site. And he was some dipshit. I didn't know who he was, but he gave me this ethical lecture about how I was a disgrace for going and competing against the business that I just sold, and he wrote this well-written two-page, you're going to burn in hell, and this thing's going to crash and burn, and I'm going to celebrate you, your failures, and what did Lipscomb teach you? And I'll never forget showing that to my wife. And that one anonymous note I read, I remember going to bed that night and said, you know what, F him, I'm going to go kick Rivals' ass. And that one note, for some reason, just hit me the wrong way. And then I started reaching out to some of the Rivals people that were more mid-level talent at the time. And, you know, I didn't feel they were very respectful. You know, I don't think that I just didn't feel they were very respectful considering, you know, our relationship in the past. And so that fueled some fire. And, you know, then we just pretty much went to work. It wasn't it wasn't like I was out there to beat Rivals. I was out there, you know, trying to build, you know, something. I was out there trying to build the top five sports site.
And so you go out and you start making a lot of hires and everything else. How much money do you raise to start 24/7?
The model was 6.4 debt and equity. We ended up at 8.8. So we overshot. We overshot by about $2.5 million. It was all private money from existing former Rivals shareholders and myself, and then we took on kind of a who's who of some local big money people in Nashville, and then a really wealthy person in Dayton. So we had a really tight group. that control the equity of the company.
And you base it in Nashville, and you start with how many employees? How much of a, and how long was your burn rate? How long did you think it would take you to actually turn profitable and start to be able to actually make some money in the business?
The model was 2 years before, you know, because we had to go compete at the level. This wasn't a small play. It was a big play. We had three high-priced tech engineers, really product leads on staff. You know, our model was to go build the best tech in the space, the best recruiting database, the best message boards, and really beat, you know, and win that endemic audience through those products, and then, you know, spend a lot of money on search and social to win that. I think after a year or two, we were still losing about $250,000 a month. So, you know, we lost a lot of money early on getting the infrastructure in place. After 3 years, you know, we probably had 60, 70 employees.
And was there ever any point where you thought, I bit off more than I can chew here? Or were you always confident that things were going to turn out well?
I knew things would turn out well, but I thought it would take longer. I thought it was going to take longer than I had modeled and take more money than I had modeled early on. And we only had one setback. The only setback was ESPN entering our space in a startup. So ESPN, long story short, I'll try to condense this. Bobby Byrne and I approached ESPN about building 24/7 sports together in a co-investment deal. We flew to Bristol. We made the pitch. They were all in. And so for 6 months, we went through extensive due diligence and strat planning with ESPN, where ESPN was going to be our partner building the business. They kept moving the deal into the point where they just offered us lucrative employment agreements. We told them to go pound sand, and then within days, they had launched a brand called Sports Nation, and they launched their version of Rivals. So they took all of our intellectual knowledge and relationships, and they started hiring. They hired somewhere around 30-something people that we had told them to go hire. And so we got pushed back 2 years by having to hire a lower-grade writer to start with than what we had originally planned, and having to pay 20-30% more in wages, because we were now competing with Rivals, Scout, and ESPN. There were four players in that space. You know, ESPN eventually shut down their team-based business, shut down Sports Nation. Scout went bankrupt yet again. Rivals basically flew to irrelevance. And, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, 24/7 hit hockey stick. So the rest is history. But those first 3 years, we were in a day-to-day fist fight with four competitors, which moved our economic model too far.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
I know there's going to be a lot of writers and people who are in sports media listening. How do you value a writer when you are starting 24/7? Because I feel I'm a little bit of a rarity in that I enjoy the business side of what I do, too. I feel like a lot of writers just want to produce content, and they don't really think about the value of the content that they produce. How do you value a writer from a CEO perspective who is running a sports media company?
Yeah, it's actually really simple. The number one value is, do you own a chunk of the news in which you're covering? If you are not breaking news, part A, and then part B, adding to the narrative with exclusive content supporting the breaking news through solid sources, you better really be good in a lot of other areas. And so, you know, what happened was so many reporters lost their way in that world because league sites and league news started team news, team sites at the college level started. People got on social media to break their own news. And the world of breaking news or having sources just really slip down to just a few people. And so, you know, a lot of reporters cry today that there aren't any great jobs. Listen, there are great jobs if you want to go do the work. There are just not a lot of people out there bringing the work. So when we first look for someone, do you own the news? Are you the number one boss in your market? Are you number two? Are you number three? And do you contribute to it? If you don't check those boxes, you go to the next box. And that is what type of influence, social influence, peer influence, which is more important than social influence to me. Are your peers in sports media, do they source you? Do they cite you? Do they have you on their TV shows, their radio shows, their blogs, their podcasts, etc.? And then the third box we check is, are you a multi-tool player? You know, can you do? Are you really good at assignment? Do you know? You know, can you create the stories, build the stories that are interesting to people? You may not be breaking the news, but can you write the stuff that are interesting? Are you good on video? Are you good on radio? You know, are you a team player? So those are the three buckets I look for.
So it's fascinating. I want to unpack a little bit of that there. It used to be, and when you first started, that getting in the room meant that you could get a job. And what I mean by that for people out there listening is, if you can be there sitting in front of Nick Saban or whoever the coach was at the time, you can write an article about what Nick Saban says, and there might only be 15 people in the room who have access to that information. Therefore, all 15 of those people are going to be able to provide some value to their audience, right? And that was sort of a cloistered universe. And then everything starts going where you got video from a statement that's going to be made. Everything is out almost immediately. And the ability to, and what I mean by that is, you used to be able, you walk out to your front porch, you open up the newspaper, and it was hard to know whether somebody was doing a great job at their local newspaper because they were one of 15 people in that room who was writing, but they didn't have anybody else they were competing with necessarily in that market in the same way, right? And then all of a sudden, everybody's competing, and you have to be able to take it to the next level and either have incredible analysis or an incredible idea of where things are going next, right? I mean, that's where you start to create the value.
That's it.
And that transition, what it did in my experience is, the people who had that value made a lot more money, but the people who didn't, who were still just in that room saying, hey, Alabama's going to, you know, rewriting whatever the press release was, they don't really have much value because the information they have has already been commodified.
Everywhere. Yep. That was a transition that's happened over the past decade with the advent or the proliferation of search and social.
Yes. And that looked like it was going to be a challenge for your business, but that's where the community aspect of your message boards and everything else comes in so strong, right? Because everybody knows what the news is, but where do they want to go talk about it as soon as the news happens? Boom, on your message board.
Yeah, and look, we built the beauty and the genius of 24/7 Sports was, we built a multi-tier distribution model and a multi-tier revenue model. You know, we make money from video, from advertising, and from subscriptions. And we get traffic from a series of six or seven major distribution plays. We're the only business model that does that. I feel the only strategic error, and we've had tons of execution errors, and I've made mistakes. I feel that the largest and really the only strategic error that I made with 24/7 Sports is, I should have been at the forefront of podcast, you know, a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Because that was that fourth, for me, that would have been my fourth revenue stream and another huge distribution. But I think I think podcast was blowing up at the time. You know, I was integrating more into CBS, and there were a lot of factors, you know, that made me an idiot, you know, as it relates to that.
But, no, I question sometimes whether, look, I'm in the audio business, and I question, one reason we're doing this podcast is I do 3 hours every morning, and you mentioned how that's a huge opportunity, local radio, to advertise the brands that you have grown in their different respective markets. But I question that all the time. Where is the audio universe going? I don't want to get left behind and be the dinosaur who's doing local, you know, who's doing radio on AM and FM dial when every single person's getting in their car and they're just saying, hey, I want the most recent thing Clay Travis has done. And boom, it just shows up on their dash or their phone or wherever they are.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, 24/7 sports is it's built to last. It's built, you know, there we'll add revenue and distribution along the way, but CBS Sports has done a phenomenal job. You know, we're a $50 million a year revenue business that is, from a margin perspective, is three times more profitable than and I can't disclose those numbers, than Rivals ever was. I mean, it's a behemoth. And, you know, and while I'm here, you know, I would love to grow my portfolio to $100 million, and that's, you know, that's my goal. I don't know that I can do that, but...
And for people who don't know, you sold 24/7 to CBS, and you're now part of the CBS Sports digital network and everything else there. How did that come about? And you said you raised initially, I think, cost you $8 million to go in. You ended up returning a pretty good return to the people who bought in.
Yeah, that was a huge win for our investors. CBS was an initial investor, a very small piece in the business, and we started having discussions with them about potentially an acquisition. They were growing, and they saw the value of being number two in sports behind ESPN. We were, you know, doing a lot of really good things in search and social, and you know, CBS, what are they? They're NFL, college sports, and you know, Augusta, outside of fantasy. So it made a lot. There were just a lot of synergies, not to use a cliche word. So it was really easy. It was an easy courtship. They already knew. They saw the whole thing unfold. They saw the moment. You know, I gave them guidance about a year before hockey stick, and I said, "You better get ready." And because, you know, we had run enough tests, we knew it was about to happen. And when our growth hit, like we saw and predicted, you know, that was an easy courtship. Then we, you know, we moved the business over. We had two successful years. I was an owner and founder of popculture.com and comicbook.com. Started communicating kind of the same things about that brand. And then CBSI, which has an unbelievable entertainment and news portfolio, saw the opportunity in those categories and those brands, and they acquired that business from us April 17. So
you have sold three businesses that started basically at nothing for $100 million or more. Is that accurate?
That'd be accurate.
How many people, and I don't know the answer to this, you may know, how many people in the world of the internet have created three different media businesses and sold each of them for $100 million or more?
Oh, I have no idea.
You might. I mean, what I'm getting at is, in the world of sports, there's been a lot of talk about who's going to make money off of the internet, right? Maybe SB Nation's going to do it. Bleacher Report sold for a decent amount of money. We'll see what ends up happening with Barstool. There have been relatively few brands that have actually hit. You've hit for two over $100 million in sports, plus... And we haven't even hardly talked about this, the pop culture and the comicbook.com, that universe as well. There can't be very many people in your neighborhood.
No, just to clarify, pop culture and comic book was an amazing return on investor and our best deal we've had, but it wasn't close to $100 million. So okay. I can't disclose. Yeah, just to be clear on that. But it was, from a return on investment, the IRR was the highest that we've had. Even higher than Rivals. It was a huge win for our shareholders, and honestly, I think both of those two brands are going to be enormous success stories for CBS down the road. I probably have as much, if not more, passion running those two brands during the day. But not to hijack your conversation or your comment, I'm incredibly proud of the work that the return that we've given our investors at Rivals, at 24/7 Sports, and then at Comic Book Pop Culture. I am also incredibly proud of the careers and the talent that we've developed in the organization. I mean, I've hired well over 1,000 people. And I've been doing this for 25 years. There's not a lot of bad stories in the organization. There's babies being born, career changes. I think we've got a really good template for building talent, developing talent, and building businesses. And it's proven by our revenue, our profits, and our success.
How much time do you spend looking at data?
All day, all time.
How do you decide what the data is that matters, basically the difference between the signal and the noise?
You know, here's the thing. I've been in so many corporate meetings and I've read so much. The way you've got to look at data is you've got to use data to disprove your theory till you're just, I can't be disproven. And the corporate world and so many people use data to support their argument. And so I have a belief that data is a debunker of your theory until it then itself is proven. And so, you know, I'm not trying to be a contrarian, but I've been in so many meetings where you slice the data up and it actually doesn't prove what the person presenting it is. And so we've always looked at it as bring me all of it and let me make sure I'm not making a mistake. And so that's just our view on it. That's the way we use it. I look at everything. There's very small pieces of our business I'm not intimately aware of.
I've seen you with the numbers, the Google Analytics. Like, I've been to your office and I've seen you following it on a minute by minute basis. I want to now kind of get into quickly here. How much do you work? Because one of the things, and I know you have four kids, one of the things that I am instilling to my kids all the time, and I think there are a lot of people out there listening who need to hear this as well. It's one thing to be good at something. You said you were good at basketball. A lot of people are good at things. There's a lot of people listening to us right now who have individual talents and lots of different things, and you may be better than 85% of people. You may be better than 90% of people. I have yet to meet somebody who ends up being successful that doesn't grind their ass off in order to be good. Maybe there are people out there who really are incredible at what they do and they only have to work 15 or 20 hours a week. I've never met them. Has that been your experience in the success that you have had, that there is no substitute for grinding?
You know, there's no substitute. And, you know, my issue is what I've learned over the last, say, 12 years is that I've learned to be incredibly more efficient when I am working. Okay. And so there's a difference between, like, as far as thinking and planning and strategizing and dreaming, you know, if I'm not sleeping or I'm not perfectly engaged with my wife or kids, you can pretty much bet that I am doing that. Okay. As far as like physically working, I don't work near as much as I used to. But the strategy part, I try to be engaged. I don't have hobbies. I play basketball four times a week. You know, and I watch Netflix or some stupid TV before I go to bed. But I'm not very social. No, I don't have a lot of hobbies. I'm not very fun. You know, what's fun to me is to try to line up and kick your ass. And the only way I'm going to be able to do that is it starts with the foundation of trying to outwork you. And that's just the way I was raised. It's, in my mind, it's the only way I'm going to be able to be successful. I'm probably not going to do it through charisma or connections or being smarter than you.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
So you wake up at like your general day now, and I know it's evolved over the years. You wake up at what time? Walk me through a typical day. And again, I know every day is different, but in your life, what is your typical day?
Right. So I wake up anywhere between 4:30 and 5 every day, no matter what. I've been doing that for years.
With an alarm, or that's just natural?
I have an alarm, but I turn it off before it turns on. I don't use snoozes. I pop up at 4:45 every day. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I play basketball. The game starts at 6, it's over at 7. those 3 days, I come back, shower real quick, and one of those 3 days I'll take my kids to school. If I don't take them to school, I'll come straight to the office. Then I'll work those 3 days, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, to about 3:30 or 4. And then I'll probably work out for like 20 or 30 minutes and then head home. I don't do anything until the kids go to bed. Kids go to bed 7:30 or 8, my younger kids. I'll catch up very briefly, and I'm in bed every night by 9:30. Tuesdays and Thursdays, same time, get up and come straight to the office and then work straight until 4 o'clock.
And that's been, are you a creature of habit? I mean, that sounds pretty detailed. So you during the work week have a pretty set schedule.
Yeah, I don't change anything. I wouldn't know how.
Why do you think getting into the office matters so much that early?
I don't have any people distractions, and I dictate my day. So all the work, I do a lot of data work and a lot of writing and a lot of communication, and you need uninterrupted time to do that. I think for whatever reason, I'm incredibly aware and much more acute at that point in time of the day than I am later in the afternoon. And it's really more of a, you know, I don't want to have the anxiety of having to get something done. And so if you get in, you knock that stuff out, it really gives you a peace of mind to then start dealing with the shit that hits the fan as the day starts transpiring. And so if you're dealing, you know, look, every day is an obstacle. Every day is a fist fight, and every day is a mess. Watch your physical, emotional, and mental health and state when you're dealing with those. I've been in periods of my life where I've gone through some stuff where I didn't make good decisions. And so I feel to make good business decisions and good life decisions, you've got to have your health and your emotional state in good order, you know, or you'll start making a series of bad mistakes. And so you take that down to the very micro level. You get up, you take care of your business, you clean your plate. You then are better prepared to deal with all of the obstacles and the crap that hits that day.
You probably, this last question for you, I want this for people to be able to listen to it for years. So I'll say this right now. We're talking in 2019. So if you're listening in 2023 or 2024, I hope you're enjoying it. And I bet that the advice will still carry through. I get asked all the time by people. It's as if they think that I have some sort of magic gift that I'm going to be able to bestow upon them. Hey, here's how you make a living in the world of sports, in media, in this universe. I'm sure you get asked it all the time, too. What do you tell people that are out there that are right now that are 16 or 17 years old that are listening to us and they want to one day be the next Shannon Terry? What do you tell them they should be doing? And maybe they're 25, maybe they're 35. What would you tell them? How do you end up doing what you do?
No, what I would say to anyone is I'm a little different than a lot of the new, you know, millennial movement. I don't think everybody should be entrepreneurs. I think only a few people actually should take those kind of risk, even risk at early ages where the really bad that could happen isn't that bad. You know, but for those that want to be entrepreneurs, that want to be, you know, trendsetters and move, I would say work in your passion, find things that you're passionate about. You know, because I've tried a few things before that I really wasn't that good at because I just didn't have a passion for it. I tried to pretend I had a passion for it. You know, I did a women's lifestyle play for a while, and it was okay, but I didn't have a passion for it, so didn't make good decisions because they weren't innate. So number one is find your passion, work in your passion. Well, everyone's going to say, I have a passion for freaking sports, okay? Well, who doesn't? That's not necessarily what I mean. You need to find a passion for something in sports. Some of my best workers aren't watching games on Saturdays because they're too tired. You know, they're not sportsaholics. They're not sports freaks. When we're interviewing people, how big a fan you are isn't even a question that we ask. We don't really care. But you need to be passionate about some service or some differentiator in sports, and you got to like it. And then the second thing I would say, and this is where the whole equation either is going to look really pretty or fall apart, does that passion align with an economic opportunity? And so many things are, well, I can do this, I have a passion for it, but it's not going to make any money. That's bullshit. And so, you know, don't get caught up in these, well, if we'll build users, we'll figure it out, or who cares, I'm not in this for money. No. If you are in business, you're in business to generate cash flow. And at the end of the day, all businesses are valued on cash flow, and how much money can be returned to investors. And so you got to find a passion, and you got to find an economic driver that aligns with that passion. And if you can check both of those boxes with a good idea or a good opportunity, it doesn't have to be entrepreneurial. It can be going to work for an enterprise where you get to do what you want to do and they're going to pay the bills. Then go forward with it. But if you can't check both those boxes, keep selling insurance or doing whatever you got to do to provide for you, you know, you and your family. That would be my advice to anyone, you know, that's thinking of doing anything remotely similar to the things that I've done.
Last question. I know I said last question, but legitimate. Do you think that you will ever start another company, or having had the success that you have in the space that you've had, do you feel like that part of your life is over?
Oh, 100%. I'm a business builder. I'm a creator. I'm an originator. And I'm a control freak. And I can honestly say I don't have any ideas brewing. I don't have any concepts. I don't have any plans to leave CVS. I love it here, and will be here for the foreseeable future, you know. But I dream about the day, you know, that I can, you know, take a lot of these experiences that I've learned, go in, disrupt something, and get up every day with the sole purpose of kicking a competitor's ass. So, you know, I look forward to that day. It's not now. I'm not ready emotionally, physically. I like what I'm doing. I like what I'm a part of. I like the people that I'm working with. And I have an unfinished business with 24/7 comic book and pop culture. But I pray there will come a day when I get to get up at 4:30 with that feeling that I've had for 2.5 decades, where I race out the door with the sole purpose, you know, of doing something disruptive, because there's no feeling like it. That adrenaline, that competitive fire, I felt it, and I want to feel it again someday.
Shannon Terry, where can they find you on Twitter if they want to come react to this? At SB Terry, I think, 24/7, is that right?
That's it, at SB Terry 24/7. I'll be hanging out there.
Outstanding stuff as always, man. Good luck in the future, and thanks for the time today.
Thanks, Clay. I really appreciate it.
Thanks to Shannon Terry. Again, he has killed it with Rivals, with 24/7 Sports, with PopCulture.com, and with ComicBook.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can reach out to him at SBTerry247 on Twitter. Let him know you enjoyed it. I'm Clay Travis. And by the way, that does make a difference for everybody out there. Jason Whitlock told me you guys reached out to him like crazy with our first podcast. If you listen to this and you enjoy it, it really does make a difference if you go reach out to the people who were the subjects and gave us their time and energy and effort to be able to spend here with you guys and me on Wins and Losses. Next one upcoming, got us a lot of awesome people lined up. I think you guys are going to love this series, but thank you so far for jumping on. We're 2 episodes in. If you haven't listened to Jason Whitlock, do it now. That was Shannon Terry. I'm Clay Travis, and this has been Wins and Losses.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.